take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Tootsie Roll of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. You are zoning out, you are vibing out to Movement 6, a very tiny part of a very long song. Movement 6, this is on Promises, which is the collaborative album of Pharoah Sanders and Floating Points. This is a big critical darling record of 2021. Today on Popcast, it's the last year end, even though we're already in January. It's the last year end wrap up. It's the Jazz Cast. We're going to talk about everything that went down in jazz last year, from the intimate to the astral and everything in between. With us, Giovanni Russinello, who writes about jazz in the New York Times. Hello, Gio. Welcome. Hi.
Hey, John. How you doing, man?
Good. Happy you're here. And Marcus J. Moore is here, who also writes about jazz for the New York Times. Hello, man. What's good?
What's going on?
Happy to have you guys here. We have a lot of ground to cover, but we're going to start here. It's Gio's number one album of 2021. It's kind of a consensus record, although Marcus, I'm not 100% sure if you ride for it as hard. But I'd love to hear, for those folks who have not heard this record, Gio, can you talk us through what the conceit of it is? It feels like it kind of came out of nowhere. It kind of landed a little bit out of nowhere. Can you tell us how it arrived into the scene?
This album, you're right, was a total critic's darling, and it did arrive with something of a concerted kind of marketing effort. And so for that reason, I sort of sat down, and as it was end of year time, I was thinking to myself, am I really going to single this one out? Is this really going to be the number one, you know? And ultimately, it just, things came together and it just continuously resonated on every listen and it was captivating. And the way that it really came together was that actually sort of a indie label guy, Eric Wiles Nystrom, I think, with Luwaka Bop, actually got the opportunity to introduce Pharoah Sanders, this going on 80 jazz legend saxophone player, to the music of Floating Points, which is Sam Shepard, this brilliant young musician in Britain, whose stuff is all over the map. It's from ambient to IDM, you know. I mean, he's a composer whose work, he plays post-rock, he plays with orchestras, he's everywhere musically. And Pharoah Sanders falls for it and says, you know, he's not made a really kind of major album under his own name for over 10 years. And he says, I would like to work with this guy. So of course, if you're Eric Wiles Nystrom, in that case, you jump on this opportunity. It took years for them to make it happen. And the result, I thought, was just breathtaking because it was different than anything either musician had ever made in a significant way. It was really patient and immersive and allowed you to listen to both yourself and the music at the same time in a way that some of both of their, you know, oofs before that were dealing with just more, you know, and they really slimmed down.
Patience is a really interesting framing for this record. To be totally frank, you know, this is, of all the records we're going to talk about today, this is probably the only one that I'd actually listened to multiple times this year. And to keep it a buck, it never fully opened up to me. And so watching the critical consensus over has been really interesting for me, because I think you're right. It doesn't fully sound like a Floating Points record, and it doesn't fully sound, even less so, like a Pharoah Sanders record. And so I think it took a while to kind of like rewire my brain to kind of process what was happening, given the uniqueness of the pairing. And I think really the last two times I listened to it, I really hit a groove with it. So that was really gratifying. What was your vibe on the record, Marcus?
I loved the record as soon as I heard it. Now, admittedly, I had to sort of tune my ear to expect something different, because I'm a huge Pharoah Sanders fan, but I love Black Unity. I love Karma. I love more of his, I guess, quote unquote frantic sort of jazz. So when I got the copy of this, I was expecting something along that vein or something that was a little more active. And when I never heard a drum on it, it was like, okay, all right, this is something different. So it was one of those where admittedly, maybe it took me a couple of listens, but it's still one of those records that I come back to. It's a perfect, you know, it's a perfect writing soundtrack. It's a perfect walking around the neighborhood soundtrack. It really hit me in that sort of way. Now, mind you, I'm still of the Black Unity Karma camp, but this is the one that, you know, it's just kind of one of those records that comes back to you and sticks with you for a long time.
Let me ask this question. In the Pharoah Sanders catalog, in the arc of what he's done, where is the consonance between this album and earlier work? Is there a period in earlier Sanders that really speaks to this, or that this really speaks to?
The sense that I got, first of all, from just listening to Floating Points' music from before, but then especially from this album, is that he knows the Pharoah Sanders catalog. Like, he's listened to the 60s albums and the 70s albums. I heard a lot of Tauhid in this one, which is his first release on Impulse Records from the 60s, Pharoah Sanders, where he made these sort of large ensemble suites that had that same long scope and that same sort of need for patience. And that's what I love, is that, like, that thing you point out, Marcus, about the confrontational nature of that music back then and the, like, giving voice to really sincere outrage is also a scenario where you have to exercise patience as a listener. You have to, like, allow this person who's performing for you or this group to, like, really say something that is somewhat difficult. So there is something to be, like, a line to be drawn between the kind of patience that you listen to this really slow, not entirely easy, but also not dissonant or confrontational music, and also the older stuff.
Marcus, does it kind of function that way to you as well?
Yeah, it functions as, you know, a record that I think when we all look back at it, it's going to be one of those records that we hold in high esteem. The funny thing about this album is, like, from what I've seen, is that you have people like us who really like the record, but then you also have people who didn't like it because they felt like it never quite came together. I've heard that criticism where it's like, okay, I need something, like Gio said, you know, to take his word, something a little more confrontational, because that's just been sort of his aesthetic. But I feel like overall, it's definitely still one of the year's best jazz records, if not the year's best jazz record, because it is one of those things that kind of forces you to come with different expectations or not come with any expectations at all. And I feel over the years, that's what Pharoah Sanders has done a really good job of, is just saying, okay, all of this over here is what the consensus is listening to, but I'm going to be brave enough, I'm going to be fearless enough to play all this other stuff over here that maybe challenges your ear. But it's one of those things where it'll reveal itself over time. And I think that's why he's been able to hang around for 50, 60 years.
Also, the left field analogous kind of recent thing that I kept returning to when I was listening to this record were the kind of the reissues, the resurgence of Beverly Glenn Copeland, which we've talked about on podcast before. You know, it's music that's thought of, it's, you know, new age. Maybe that's a pejorative to some people. I don't consider that a pejorative, but the patience and emotionality of the music, in my mind, is in dialogue with the thoughts, the thinking around Beverly Glenn Copeland that's been going on for the last couple of years. And I thought listening to it refracted through that was actually even maybe a little more revelatory than listening to it refracted through what has Pharoah Sanders done before or what has Floating Points done before. It was an interesting distant cousin thing going on there.
Yeah, I think of LaRaji as well, and how much LaRaji has been embraced recently, and also how much LaRaji has dabbled back into playing just the piano and sort of using, you know, what you might call a jazz acoustic approach. But then I think about, yeah, why is Pharoah Sanders doing this now? What is he here in this moment? And, you know, you don't always think to look to an 80-year-old jazz musician for, like, how should we be listening to this moment? But there is something about 2021 and the year of vibes, right? The fact that we were all talking about vibes, and the fact that, like, it was, everything was very difficult to pin down, and that was just fine. And that really showed up in music too. And it's not coincidental, I think, that somebody as visionary and as protean as Pharoah Sanders is able to have been would end up here, right? In this moment in 2021, making music that takes like really personal investment from the listener. You have to listen to yourself listening to this music somehow. It's that quiet. And there was so much other good music like that this year too. And Beverly Glenn Copeland too.
Marcus, on your list that you put out of the albums that you enjoyed this year, there was an album that I think y'all referred to as being in a similar space, and that's the Nahlas & Nephra record. Should we listen to something off that album?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you want to hear?
I would say Space 6.
Okay, let's get into it. Nahlas & Nephra, Space 6. Marcus, tell me a little bit about this artist and this album.
In keeping with the theme of what we're talking about now, especially with Pharoah Sanders, this was another record, at least for me, that came out of nowhere where, you know, Nahla is a young jazz musician. She plays synth and she plays harp. And she essentially just convened various groups of musicians in London and just went to the studio and vibe. At least according to press material, she would have the lighting at a different setting, and she would have like certain temperatures in the room. Like everything was all in tune to this music that she wanted to put out. And the backstory to it is that she actually had a health scare a few years ago. So this music represents the music that she needed to hear to feel better and to heal herself as much as she could. And so every song on here is a piece of that, you know. So like Space 6 is more aggressive, and you have other ones that are more ambient and more in keeping with the theme of the podcast. You know, it's a lot of vibes on it. You know what I'm saying? So you have all these different things working together. And she's the architect of this, but she also has, like, for instance, Nabaya Garcia is on it and other people are on it, like that are more veteran. But the thing that I love about this record is that it feels a lot like Alice Coltrane in that way, you know, and just taken from that same sort of era, Pharoah Sanders and Impulse Records and what have you. So yeah, this is one that kind of snuck up on me and I haven't been able to put it down since.
Very cool record. Really cool. Really was excited to listen to.
The Alice Coltrane analogy is both so frustrating because it's, you know, it's one that you would just naturally want to resist because it's so clearly the one that's closest at hand, but it works so well, especially because you think of Coltrane coming back from a place of healing as well, making those records in the late 60s, early 70s, after years of being really shaken by having to parent without her husband. That energy is in that. And I wonder, John, like, how do you hear this music in relationship to other ambient and, you know, non-jazz stuff? Because I feel like the lines around jazz and experimental music and pop music are blurring, and it's sort of in that ambient space.
I will say one thing that I was struck by about albums on both of your lists, some albums, not all, but one thing I was struck by, I mean, these are boring conversations to have, but like there were certainly albums on both lists where I was like, is this jazz? You know, like genuinely, like, is that what this is? And of course, those boundaries are useless and meaningless, but pop, and I don't mean like radio oriented pop, but certainly maybe things that are happening on a more micro level, maybe things that are happening on SoundCloud. There's a flirtation with the ambient that's already happening. And it's funny, when I was looking for the Sam Gendel and Sam Wilkes album to listen to, the first thing that actually pops up on Spotify was not this. It was a collaboration they did with Maggie Rogers. And so when I think about singers like that who are, you know, you wrote your piece about duos, and I will get to that, but I think there's so much intimacy and smallness happening in the singer-songwriter world, and that has always been the case, but it gets amplified just so much more because of the internet. You're more proximate to it now. That conversation between singers like that, and then obviously musicians like Gendel and Wilkes, and then the Nahlas & Nephra record, which I would not be surprised if this musician ended up in a studio with, I don't know, Marcus, maybe someone you've written about, you know, like I can see there are certain members of the hip hop community that I think would absolutely enjoy working off of this kind of template.
And I'm trying to, like, I don't know. I hope we don't necessarily just have to always talk about how amazing Pink Sifu and Georgia Ann Muldrow are on every time we get together and talk. But we talked about it last year, and those names come to mind for sure here.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, Nubia was on it, I thought, I was like, yeah, that makes so much sense because she's such a collaborative person as well. And Nala, it just seems like she has the juice right now. Everybody I was talking to about that record, which ironically, I was in London when it kind of fell in my lap. I was just talking to people and they were like, oh, yeah, like, no, she plays this venue. She's over here. She's over here. And we knew she was amazing. You guys are just catching up. We knew she was awesome.
Can we talk about the Gendel and Wilkes stuff? Because I think this might be a logical place to jump. So this is the second album from this pairing. It's on your list, Gio. It's called Music for Saxophone and Bass Guitar, More Songs. What do you want to hear off this album?
Let's do the last track, which is Greetings to Idris, More Songs. So kind of the second version of cover they've done since they first started making this music.
So this is maybe a non-musical thing, but it did strike me. The photo of these guys that accompanies your list, Gio, it's like of them on a bench or something, like busking. It's giving, maybe it's, I don't know if that photo or it's another photo I saw, but it's giving busker.
That's basically it.
Okay, so talk me through that.
They recorded this record. I should mention the song we just heard is actually a Pharaoh cover, so just to tie it all together. But they basically recorded a couple of albums worth, at least, who knows, maybe there's more of material while they were playing outside of these restaurants in LA. And it was sort of this, you know, medium space, this vibe between being a performance and not, between being a jam session that they'd carried from Sam Gendel's living room out to the street where I think they maybe knew the guys who ran the restaurant or something and were allowed to do it, but super low key. And you mentioned smallness, right? We were talking about that quality being something that maybe musics have in common these days across artificial lines. And I'm thinking about how like both smallness and like the hugeness and like the fullness and the trying to fill an entire space with an ambient sound, right? Like this music does. How those are going really hand in hand, right? It's like I guess it's a personal screen thing or a personal apparatus experience, right? But these guys make, because they're a duo, they seem to be able to make this really close, really small music that creates a world, but has that smallness and yet to still make it about relating to each other, which is this whole other thing, you know? And that's what keeps it, answering that question, is it jazz? That's maybe what keeps it in the jazz realm for me, is that these musicians are playing with each other, improvising and having to deal with each other in real time.
And that's sort of a thrust of a piece you wrote a few weeks ago about essentially the year in collaboration, in direct collaboration, and this notion that given what the last 2 years have been like globally because of the pandemic and because of the ways that our ability to gather have been altered, what we're hearing, coincidentally or not, or what we're seeking out is this kind of conversation. It's a conversation between two people that's almost reassuring when we're all disaggregated in this way.
Because I think I spent 2020 as a jazz listener trying to think about, oh, okay, we're all alone. We're all with our screens. What are jazz musicians doing? You know, that question. How are they doing this? What are they doing? And I'm like, well, nothing really. It doesn't work. It's not the music. And the next best thing, I think, is what I came to in 2021. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe some musicians are safely gathering in pairs, you know, or more importantly, like, they've always been doing music in duets and they continue to, and it's not necessarily been a great year for duets. It's just that I think I listened particularly hard to that because I couldn't deal with just, you know, trying to recreate some digital version of relating in jazz. But the next best thing sort of was what we settled with this year.
Were there great records this year from that were recorded during the pandemic that are, you know, quartet records, quintet records, like big band, like bigger band records? Like, is there a lot of stuff like that that's happened in the last 24 months? Or is that stuff just not as present right now?
Probably not as thick on the ground as it might have been, but I think it's certainly still happening.
There's actually this one band in particular, this band leader named Telemachus. He came out with a record called The New Heritage. And it was totally recorded during the pandemic. He was recording his stuff in his room and he was sending files to people. They were doing stuff over video chats and Zoom and what have you. maybe another theme is emerging. This was another one that just kind of snuck up on me, you know, and I feel like that's what we've been saying about every record so far. It's like, oh, it just kind of surprised us.
That might just be the state of the world. Right? Like we're all just vulnerable, laying in wait, and just like literally any sensation or feeling is like, what? Hey, whoa, hey, oh, slow down there. Slow down, buddy. Slow down. Might be that.
That might be it, because this was another one. This was another one, man, where it was just like, oh, wow. Okay. Like, I didn't even know it existed until, like, I saw a tweet. And then it was like, oh, damn. Okay. I got to play this. So, like, yeah, that's definitely a record that really stuck with me that was recorded totally in isolation, apart from other band members. But you wouldn't tell when you listen to the music.
Let's play something off this album. What do you want to hear?
Let's play City Dreams.
Okay, so when I listened to this record, I was like, yo, Marcus knows my sweet spots. Jeez. I was like, this record goes. This record really, really goes. Like, and it goes in a way that I think, to me, there's a logical thread from here all the way back to the early 90s experiments of jazz flirting with hip hop or hip hop flirting with jazz. And to me, there's a thread that you can absolutely draw from there to here. This record felt very grounded to me, but also playful at the same time. There were unexpected moments and juxtapositions and jolts, but I never really felt like it was fickle in any way. It all seemed deeply considered.
It also, to me, felt like it's something that could come out on Brainfeeder.
Tell me about the background. Is this American? Is this British? Is this something else?
No, it's American. It's American. Okay. Yeah, this guy's in Northern California. It came out on this underground label called Radio Juicy, which I had never heard of. Apparently, he's been creating for a little while, but he was very taken by, like what you said, like the 90s, the 80s, Dilla. And to me, at least, my ear was attuned to, it felt to me like, late 70s Herbie, early, like maybe 1980 Herbie, like Mr. Hands Herbie.
Yeah.
Felt like that to me as well, where it's like, it's jazz, but it's also some fusion in there. You got some sort of ambient going on. It's a lot going on at the same time, but he's still able to land on something that's his own aesthetic. It's like you hear the influences of what he's trying to do. But you never feel like he's trying to like mimic a Herbie Hancock record. And I thought that's what made it stand out for me. It's like, here's a guy who, quite frankly, I hadn't heard of. I mean, it's a cell phone, but
safe space.
Yeah. So I hadn't heard of him, but now he's a guy where it's like, man, I got to pay attention to everything that he does now because his music is that resonant.
And is the label also like, is there a lot of stuff on this label that's in this vein, or is it relatively new or novel?
This, to me, is relatively newer novel. I hadn't heard of the label before this project. Now, mind you, I'm pretty sure there'll be a lot of Radio Juicy fans out there like, what, are you crazy?
Exactly.
Like,
you know. Podcast at nytimes.com for all your complaints. Yep.
Right, don't put it back on here. But no, I hadn't heard this label before, this Telemachus. But now, like even now, I'm scrolling and it just seems like something I need to pay attention to moving forward.
Gio, what do you make of records like this that are mining that particular history, that particular era?
Another thing we always come back to when we talk about this stuff, John, is like that trip hop legacy.
You keep bringing
us back to that acid jazz era. But you're right that, like, I don't know, people have 90s nostalgia now, apparently, and I feel like it's going to catch up to us in every kind of way, right? Is that what you hear?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, the kids on TikTok are already in like 2014, but like, you know, it's, right. you know, we can still have the 90s
terrifying.
Nostalgia.
We'll move slow. Yeah. Here we are.
Oh my God, it's beyond terrifying.
Right.
I was like, I was at those parties. You can't already No. You can't do that. One more record before we kind of pivot and talk about like archival stuff and so on and so forth. One more record that maybe falls a little bit into this lane. And this is something, Marcus, you had mentioned in one of your emails, is the More Mother record.
More so the Irreversible Entanglements record that came out. Like, she came out with a couple of records. She came out with a solo album that was more hip hop.
That was the Black Encyclopedia of the Air, yeah. That album.
Yeah, yeah. So that was more hip hop, but Irreversible Entanglements, I guess it's their third. This was their third record. And this one, to me at least, Gio, I don't know if you heard something different. To me, this one felt brighter than the first two. Like, I felt like the first one was definitely rooted in, like, Black Lives Matter. It was coming out of, like, the anger of watching Black people get killed by police. The second one was sort of a coming out of that, but it was more, it felt more reflective. And it felt like More Mother, at least, was, you know, kind of taken from memories of the past. And this one, to me, at least to my ear, felt way more festive. And I think that's the reason why it's also called Open the Gates, where it's like, yeah, those past two records represent a time in which the music needed to sound angry and it needed to sound furious. But this new album is more of like a sort of a new dawn, and it's moving towards something a little bit brighter. There's some electronic going on in there, and it's not as straight ahead free jazz as the first two. This one was more so like jazz meets, I would say, like, there's some Afrobeat. There's more like New Orleans second line and sort of subgenres of that ilk.
On top of that, I know we did skip past the More Mother record really quickly, but when I listened to that album, it really got me thinking of like early Roots Maneuver records, kind of like that late 90s into early 2000s British post-dub moment, and kind of like trying to like crack open what an experimental avant-garde hip hop might sound like, informed by the American underground of the 90s. I heard a lot of that energy on that More Mother album. So that was really, for me, very engaging. I know this has also been kind of a big year for looking backwards, archival work, etc. Gio, talk us through a little bit of the bigger boxes and bursts of the year.
Man, yeah, what a good year for the historical releases. Honestly, the Coltrane record that came out this year, and now it seems like every year brings a new Coltrane release, if not more. But whoever's doing this includes members of his family, Robbie Coltrane, the Impulse Records team. They're timing things brilliantly because it's sort of like they keep outdoing themselves. And this Coltrane archival release this year was the live performance of A Love Supreme during a historic run of shows in Seattle in 1965. And that was, I mean, you know, the kind of recording in jazz history alone, no matter whether it had been discovered now or it had been, you know, released immediately, that was, I think, destined to go down as significant because this suite, A Love Supreme, is really, as its title suggests, on a spiritual and just a historic level, sort of untouched in the jazz pantheon. And then this live performance, which we don't have any live performances really of this suite. We have literally three now. And each one that we have is obviously a completely different experience. And in this case, he's got Farrah Sanders coming up again here. And Sanders is actually one of three musicians who are not part of the core quartet who are on this very singular recording. So that in and of itself would have made this a good year for archival releases. Then we had others. And I know, Marcus, you've written about some of them, especially that Roy Brooks record, which is incredible. The Lee Morgan collection, the box set from the Lighthouse, pretty incredible. Can you talk about the Roy Brooks? Because I found your article so beautiful about his history.
Roy Brooks, I feel like, is one of those jazz artists. And this could just be my chip on my shoulder talking, but I feel like he's one of those people where we don't talk about him enough, but you don't realize that this is a person we need to talk about until you actually hear the music. So with Understanding, as I recall, it was recorded in Baltimore. And the thing that I love about it, you know, just kind of going back to the top, it just has a lot of fire and it has a lot of intensity. And it's one of those records where it was recorded at a time where we're coming out of the civil rights movement, we're coming out of the Black Panther movement. It just has a lot of bass and fire to it. And like the songs are really these long extended grooves. And I think when you go back and you listen to that record in comparison with this other record, he had another record called Ethnic Expressions that he recorded in Harlem in 1970. I almost feel like those are two bookends. I feel like, you know, when you listen to the Roy Brooks, it's more so setting up what he's doing on Understanding.
Should we play something off these Roy Brooks records?
Yes. Let's play Understanding.
While we are looking backwards, I know that there have also been some interesting documentaries this year. Gio, do you want to talk about Fire Music for a sec?
Yeah, it was a really good year for jazz docs. This one, I think they've been trying to get distributed for a minute because I definitely saw it well over a year ago, so bear with me. But it's really, I think, for me, one of the first, close to comprehensive as you can come, and thorough and fairly honest and searching films that have been made about fire music, which is to say, like the avant-garde jazz made mostly in New York City, but really throughout the country and in some ways beyond in the 60s and 70s, as the 60s sort of gave way to the 70s, really the music of the avant-garde in the Black Power years. It just sort of told the story with a level of inquiry into the message that I think was due, you know, something that was happening both on screen and in books. Like there was this amazing Daphne Brooks book, which is, you know, something like 500 pages. So I'm not going to pretend to have read it all, but Liner Notes for the Revolution, The Intellectual Life of Black Feminist Sound, incredible work. There was a book called Crossing Bar Lines by James Gordon Williams, which has a sort of similar approach to the Daphne Brooks in terms of like really trying to interrogate what is within, as the writer calls it, the politics and practices of Black musical space. And yeah, so this documentary really kind of got in there and made an earnest attempt, I think, in a way that past jazz biographers have often been criticized for not doing.
On the opposite end of the jazz spectrum.
Yeah. Here we go.
There was one other documentary this year, and that documentary was called Listening to Kenny G. Now, I have to say up front, this is a Ringer film. The Ringer is run by my dear friend, Sean Fennessy. You know, so I have a personal connection to the people who were responsible for making sure this film got made. So I want to just caveat that up front. That said, I have talked to Sean at length about this film, and so he knows what I think. Nothing that I say here will come as a shock.
So if you're going to caveat what you're about to say, I'm going to caveat my silence back there, because the only reason I didn't speak up in support of that Irreversible Entanglements record, which is phenomenal, is because I know the bassist so personally, and he and I, Luke Stewart, work together. So caveats on the table, cards on the table.
Cards on the table. So now, okay, the Kenny G movie is basically, why does everyone hate Kenny G? Or why do serious jazz people hate Kenny G? It's premised upon that. It's a biography of Kenny G, but it's really through the lens of why is he not taken seriously? And the reason that we are talking about it in this conversation, at least in part, the first X amount of minutes of this movie are devoted to people struggling to understand why Kenny G is liked. One of those people is Ben Ratliff, the former jazz critic in the New York Times, former host of Popcast. It is hilarious. I saw this in a theater at whatever film festival was playing at, and I damn near fell out of my chair when I saw that man on the big screen.
That must have been a fun watch in a
tremendous
group. That's amazing.
Shout out, Ben. Love you. Miss you.
The comic timing in that
interview. Oh, my God. If there's any people who have ever listened to podcasts and been like, I wish that I didn't have John's antic hosting and instead I had Ben's patient cutting hosting, go watch the Kenny G documentary. It'll give you a fix. Okay.
They are two distinguished eras of their own.
Exactly. Distinct and distinguished, both.
Exactly.
So my punchline about this film is that seeing Kenny G through the lens of jazz is actually wrong. It's wrong. So the idea that everybody who's lined up to kind of like bop them on the head is a jazz person, to me, feels lightly disingenuous, especially when you think of the era that Kenny G became popular in. It's right on the tail end, or really in concert with, Quiet Storm R&B, a lot of like gentle, sensuous stuff happening in pop and also in R&B. And there's definitely intersection between those kind of hyper romantic Kenny G instrumentals and very, very delicate, devotional, light soul that was happening in that space.
There's so much there, right? There is another movie that needs to be made, or another inquiry that needs to be led into, all right, jazz people accuse this man of violence all the time on their tradition and their values and their ethics. And you're right, to the degree that they're interacting, I mean, he doesn't share those values or those ethics or that tradition particularly. So it becomes really confounding. But at the same time, he's had as much of an impact, like you said, on the pop and on the R&B ecosphere, right? That is actually dealt with to some degree in this movie, which, hats off. I mean, it's a good documentary, right? Like, they get in there.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't want to diminish the film. It's a really good film. It's just, I just was like, that part was missing for me.
Exactly, because like you listen to, let's like another figure in the middle, Robert Glasper. I always am fascinated by the amount that he loves to shout out Kenny G. And he likes to say, sort of as holding it up to people, saying, yo, like, if you're really going to pass judgment so much on what people like, just sit back and look at the numbers a little bit. And then, like the sort of the filmmaker says in this documentary, like, you can't, you know, you can't argue with a guy who says you can't argue with success, right? I mean, so, but Glasper is trying to issue some sort of corrective about, like, jazz and R&B sharing a tradition, essentially. So it's a concern on both sides, right? Like, if Kenny G is somebody who looms for him in that project, how much has Clive Davis's decision to write personal letters on behalf of Kenny G to all the radio stations when he wasn't doing that for Grover Washington and he wasn't necessarily doing it for, I don't know, like, Peebo Bryson never got that kind of treatment, but he could have, you know, deserved it, you know, like.
Justice for Peebo Bryson. Oh my God. Like, and if anyone has a Peebo Bryson t-shirt in extra large, let me know.
But you hear me, right? I mean, like,
absolutely.
It's just, you're right. And his impact is felt everywhere. So that's why it's interesting to look at, okay, forget the jazz thing. What is his value system? What is his ethic? Like, what is driving Kenny G? And why did it resonate in 1982? And like, why was it so perfect for 1982?
I also love that you are locating this conversation around Kenny G in the context of a very, very serious jazz musician's very, very serious project to talk frankly about dissolved borders that maybe were never truly there in the first place.
You mean Kenny G? No, I'm kidding.
Robert. Robbie G. Right. I mean Robbie
right,
G.
Robbie G. Exactly.
Robbie G. So it's a fascinating, like, retroactive lens to look, even if you didn't have this documentary, it's a fascinating retroactive lens to look at Kenny G. And to your point, does Kenny G share an ethic with, let's say, the jazz critics or historians who are in that film? I don't know if he does. The thing that I was probably most struck by, and I actually would be really curious to hear your perspective on this, is what I felt like I was hearing from Kenny G himself in that movie was that, yes, he understands the grammar. He listened to the records. He learned how to play the licks. He understands the grammar, but he had no particular ambition to either strictly be a part of that scene or sound, or to use that as anything other than a toolkit for the thing that was in his head, which is why it infuriates people, because it uses the same technical skill set, theoretically. It uses that technical skill set, but it puts it in service of a completely opposite or opposing or outlier thing.
Right. I'm lingering on what you said about him sharing possibly an ethic with critics who disparage him, but who also are participating in this apparatus that overlooks certain artists, right, and is racialized. But I don't know that I would say he shares an ethic, because we'll get, like, that's what you were asking about in the second half of that question, I think. Like, what is his ethic? Like, I think he just shares levers to power, right? He just shares access to lubrication that, you know, certain careers do and don't. And I think the critics, definitely, by giving him the power that he had, were participating, which is a point Daphne Brooks makes in this book so beautifully, actually. But like that, it doesn't mean that they shared an ethic, because I do think that when he listens to those canonical jazz records, and actually he does say in the film that he didn't come to the Coltranes and the Hot Fives and Sevens records that Louis Armstrong made and everything, the foundational stuff, until later. But he was playing in funk bands in the 70s when
exactly.
You could sort of get away with fake funking, faking the funk in a jazz context. So you were faking many things at once.
But to me, that's the takeaway, right? Like, to me, the takeaway is not, here's someone who studied as a, like, did like a monastic jazz study and then bastardize it. It's like, here's someone who basically was in like a high school light funk band and basically Duolingoed jazz.
Yes, well, exactly, because he heard Grover Washington, and what a lot of people do is they hear something and they say, I'd like to do that, and then they never do, and that's fine, because they didn't quite get there, right? A lot of other people, or a few other people, say, I'm going to learn everything that guy learned times two, and I'm going to figure out my way in, right? He didn't do that. He said, I like that, and then he kind of got by on enough talent. But then he never learned more than he just barely had to. And the thing that struck me the most about his MO is that he would make music by playing a single melody and asking his band to create the backing around it. He didn't. He proudly says, I don't understand harmony. He proudly says, I never had to learn harmony. And that's what's genius about me. I don't know that it's what's genius about him, but it's definitely what's singularly individualistic about his way of making music. And that is crazy to me in the jazz context, which is why you're right.
Which is why, to me, the thing that's most baffling, and we will let go of this particular thing, but like that is what why it was the most baffling part of the film is a bunch of people being like, in a jazz context, this is reprehensible. And then it's Kenny G being like, in a jazz context, I agree. That's not what I'm doing. So, you know, for anyone who's ever been mis-slotted or misapprehended or mis-genred or miscategorized, maybe you could relate to the energy in the Kenny G film. Anyway, that's enough on that. That's our show. Thank you, Gio.
Thank you.
Marcus, thank you so much. Appreciate you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It is also, as I said, it's sort of the last 2021 show, even though we're in January. At this time in every year, I like to look back over all the episodes, gather up the names, and thank everybody who came on podcast this year. Let's run them down because it was a great year, a really great year. Obviously, you know, podcast, we don't get anywhere without the rest of the crew. Karen Gans, Joe Coscarelli, John Perellis, Ben Cesario, and Lindsay Zolads, all of whom did multiple lifts this year and without whom podcast would not be what it is. We had a gang of people, a lot of new people on the show this year. I was really excited about that. Just going to run down everybody's name. Stretch Armstrong, Elena Bergeron, Jason Buford, Justin Charity, Taja Cheek, Troy Clausen, Naima Cochran, Justin Curto, Liz Day, Jim DeRogatis, Smokey Fontaine, Bobito Garcia, Sandra Garcia, Sasha Geffen, Roger Django, Jesse Green, Simran Hans, Isabella Herrera, Amanda Hess, Charles Holmes. I remember what you said to me, Charles. Olivia Horn, Jasmine Hughes, Jeff Haza, Gil Kaufman, Margot Labatt, Taylor Lorenz, Jefferson Mao, Jill Mapes, Gail Mitchell, Marcus J. Moore, Eric Morris, Marissa Moss, Larisha Paul, Yo Phillips, Alphonse Pierre, Kurt B. Riley, Alex Robert Ross, Jason Rodriguez, Dante Ross, Giovanni Russinello, Dan Rice, A.O. Scott, Sean Sataro, Philip Sherburn, Laura Snapes, Doreen Sanfelix, Samantha Stark, Cam Sullivan Brown, Rachel Seville Tashin, Opulent Tips on an Opulent Podcast, Mina Tavakoli, Daytwan Thomas, Elizabeth Vincentelli, Natalie Weiner, Hunter White, Lena Wilson, and Steph Yatka. What a wild year. Year two of the pandemic. Recording this in the home office, it is always a bit of an adventure. Pedro Rosado, our producer, a hero week in, week out. We can't do it without you.
Where's my cape?
Well, you know where your cape is? You know where you earn your cape?
When?
When we go out with a little bit of that sweet, sweet silhouette. It's your boy Kenny G, and I'm Johnny C. See you next week.
Oh, yeah.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. with nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music field trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.